So we got as far as the verses on training in skill and means. So just to explain those verses, we have more complicated bits of things in them. So this is all these trainings, by the way, are on all of the three pure lands. So they're all kind of simultaneously, or, you know, they're all found on the three pure lands. Three pure grounds, sorry. Yeah, well, if only. So it says in verse 62, as for these trainings having objects, so the objects could be the three doors of liberation, whatever they are, and the 37 harmonies of enlightenment. Do you remember those from all the different 173 aspects that we encountered as the first topic of the fourth chapter? All the 173 aspects, which, you know, training in complete aspects is training in all those 173. Well, there's one group of them was the 37 harmonies of enlightenment. That began with the four close placements of mindfulness, which we did, spend a token amount of time on. Then there's the four correct abandonings, four legs of magical emanation, five powers, five strengths, seven branches of enlightenment, eight branches of Arya paths. So these are the things that the person on this topic of training in skill and means, that's the sort of thing they have as objects, this training having objects. So that's the kind of thing that they're meditating on still. It's still those same 173 aspects, but it mentions those in particular. And then it has sort of 10 features or something, 10... Here it speaks of 10 different manners of accomplishing those trainings. But it's like 10 different, I don't know what they are, 10 things that happen, or 10 features of what they're doing. So we can look at those on page 164, 165 of the handbook. They're listed there. So the cryptic kind of just one word each that you get in the verses. You can just glance at those on page 164, 165 of the handbook. So it says, the application of skillful means that has transcended the maras. Are you with me? Yeah? So the exalted wisdom of a bodhisattva on the 10th crown surpasses or overcomes the four maras, such as Mara of the son of the gods, because it surpasses any interference through the power of practice. So it overcomes the four maras, it overcomes the obscurations, but the four maras have sort of been finally overcome. But that's not until the 10th crown, so only right at the end. So the four maras are the maras of the afflictions, the mara of the aggregates, the mara of death, and the mara of the son of the god, which is more like the mara who you imagine in the picture when Buddha becomes enlightened. There's a mara who's trying to disrupt his concentration, an interfering, you know, other being, like a mischievous kind of a being, spirit being or something, like the chief of the maras, like Satan or somebody, you know, who is a sort of personification, well, an actual being, I think, who's trying to tempt Mara with the dancing ladies and so forth, and asking him why he thinks he's got a right to get enlightened, so that Buddha touches the earth to show that, it brings the earth to witness, to show that he's earned his reward by three countless great ends of practice or whatever. So there is a digression onto what the maras are in the Perfection of Wisdom commentaries at this point, but I don't think we're going to go there because we haven't got time. So number two of the features of the application of skill and means, it abides conventionally without abiding ultimately. So I think this, well, we'll just read what it says and have to pass on. The exalted wisdom of Bodhisattva on the 10th ground possesses the application or training of abiding conventionally without abiding ultimately with respect to all phenomena. because of having meditated on the equality of all phenomena of being empty of true existence. So I suppose it just takes things to exist conventionally without taking them to exist inherently. You know, it knows the conventional nature of the phenomena without grasping it to be inherently existent. The inherent existence may appear, but there's no apprehension of it anymore. And that is propelled, the training of skillful means, number three, that is propelled by the force of previous prayers for others' welfare. The exalted wisdom of Bodhisattva on the 10th ground possesses the application of being propelled to accomplish others' welfare by the force of former prayers made by the Bodhisattva. Because of having accomplished the prayer, may I enact others' welfare spontaneously. So, you can read descriptions in the handbook, and then if you want to know more about them, or read different versions, you know, different ways presented, you can read the, you know, Brunholz's book, Groundless Paths, and there's Gareth Sparham's translation of Tsongkhapa's Golden Rosary, Golden Garland of Eloquence, on the perfection of wisdom. So all of those, when you read all three, or even, you know, read other commentaries, when you study the basic program full time, there's the commentary by Jetsunpa, isn't there, the textbook writer for Serajay Monastery. So his commentary is translated. I think if you look in the materials of the basic program, you can look at what he's saying about these things. So when you read different versions, then you start to get the idea of, well, they're talking about something, you know, that you can make sense of. But we haven't got time to sort of go into that kind of detail now. So just pointing that out to you, that those are there for you know, further study. But too much of them in one go is a bit of an overdose. So we don't have to go much further there. But maybe I could say something a little bit about the Buddha bodies, because that's obviously, you know, sort of something that we really ought to know about. So maybe we should look at the handout for this week. And if you look in the handbook, as some of you probably already have, you know, there's a description of the Buddha bodies, a little bit of a detail in each of these nine, tenth, and 11th applications. You know, there's a little bit of a conversation, a little bit of a description of the different types of Buddha bodies. And if you look in the introduction, where he talks about paths, there might be a little bit of a mention of the Buddha bodies. There's no sort of separate section in the introduction describing the Buddha bodies, but there are bits here and there in this handbook. But first of all, we'll start off with the handout, because there is one Buddha body that's mentioned in the handout that isn't mentioned in those three trainings. You see, there's three trainings, the three Buddha bodies in the fourth chapter, training in the equality of mundane existence of peace, training in a pure land, training in skillful means. But in the fourth chapter, sorry, in the eighth chapter, where the Buddha bodies are detailed, then there are four bodies mentioned. So there's one body mentioned in the eighth chapter that isn't mentioned as a fruit of one of these three trainings in the fourth chapter. So that body is the nature body. So that's the first of the bodies mentioned in the eighth chapter. So it's first on my list on the handout. Heard of the nature body? No, it is Svabhavakaya or something. That's, if you want it in Sanskrit. So you've heard of it? Good. Yeah. Okay. So that means at least one person's heard of it. You all studied it and one person remembers it. Great. Yeah, sva, sva bhava. Sva means own and bhava means nature. So it's something like nature body. It's special, yeah. What's special about it? Well, let's look at the definition for what that's worth. This is from Jamyang Shepa, translated by Jeffrey Hopkins. The final element that is endowed with the two, natural purity and purity from adventitious defilements, is the definition of native body. So this is, it's not like, it's permanent, yeah? It's like the one body that is not a functioning thing. When you say uncompounded, that means, uncompounded phenomena means not functioning thing. It's not a cause, it's not an effect, it's not impermanent. Just like emptiness, you see. So, element or reality in that definition, you see, it's not mind, it's not some sort of form, it's however, you kind of form which is very rarefied, form which is like light, Buddhist form bodies are going to be very sort of supernal and kind of, very delicate or very, fine, not like the gross form that we're made of. But this isn't even form, neither mind nor matter. This is a permanent phenomena, just the emptiness. The final element that is endowed with the two, natural purity and purity from adventitious defilements. So element, he says, Demaloja Rinpoche, that means, you understand, it's a permanent thing then. Element or reality signifies this is the uncompounded body, i.e. this is the one body of the four that is permanent. Moreover, each body of a Buddha is a Buddha. So that's another thing to remember. Buddha is the name for the whole collection of all four bodies. Yeah, so Buddha has four bodies. If you divide Buddha, you can talk about four different aspects. But each body is called a Buddha as well. Interestingly enough, some kind of, special quality that the Buddha's body deserves, that they all deserve to become a body. And this is the reason, why Buddha is permanent. If you say, considering they say Buddha, is he permanent? You should say yes. So it's permanent because there's common locus with permanent. Because there's one body of his which is permanent. So there's one thing you posit which is a Buddha and is permanent. So for that reason, Buddha himself is permanent. Pardon? Cessation. I was listening to Jane, sorry. I didn't catch what she said. She said something about cessation. But we'll come to that in a minute. What it actually means by natural purity. And purity from adventitious defilements. Yes?
I was just going to say that I remember reading about usage of this word body, but it's rather misleading. But I can't remember the suggestion that was made from the translation. I wondered if you had another translation for a different word.
Yeah, given that one of them is permanent, body might be a bit misleading, and one of them refers to the Buddha's wisdom, the Dharmakaya. So the wisdom truth body. So you might think, well, why are they calling bodies? Well, they're just using a direct translation from the Tibetan word ku, which is like honorific for body. But it's like the English word body. It can mean more than just the body of an animal, body of a living being. Body can have sort of more abstract meanings too. But yeah, Alexander Berzin in his website, he criticizes the word body, but he says corpus instead of body. So he's some sort of Latin scholar or something. Corpus. But other people, like Brunholz, say just keep the kaya, you see. They just keep the Sanskrit. They say, oh yeah, if you translate it into English, there's no satisfactory term, So we'll just keep the Sanskrit kaya. So dharmakaya, svabhavakaya, nirmanakaya. So they go like that. Well, yeah, it could be less misleading, but it's a bit opaque, isn't it? Kaya, so. But yeah, you won't be thinking of just those slabs of beef hanging up in the slaughterhouse. Oh, look at all those bodies. Yeah, a body of work, my collected works, his body of music or something, or the body of parliament, you know, or something like that.
It's
yeah, yeah, so, as I say, body does have some, you know, less meaty kind of meanings, even in English. So, that's always up for grabs. How you actually translate the word into good, comprehensible English. But yeah, so what we've got here, anyway, then you can decide what you call it by what is the meaning. So the natural purity, so the Buddha himself, however we conceptualize him in general, him or her, you know, we don't even want to have a gender, really, because it's not the main thing, isn't the form, appearance. That's just a convenient technique, you know, for appearing so that somebody can appreciate you and communicate with you, you know. But Buddha, in and of him, her, or itself, isn't particularly in either of the two genders. What's the main bit of the Buddha? Is it the all-knowing, exalted wisdom? I don't know. Anyway, the nature body, or the nature kaya, has two aspects. It's like the emptiness. So the one is that it's naturally empty from the beginning. That's the natural purity, just as the table is naturally empty from the beginning. So it's the emptiness of whatever you've arrived at. Well, the Buddha's mind was empty from the beginning anyway, from whenever he was a sentient being, before he even became a Buddha. But maybe they're not talking about that, but it's just anything is you talk about is that exists is naturally pure in the sense it's been empty since whenever. And purity from adventitious defilement. So this is more specific to a Buddha, uniquely specific, because the Buddha's got rid of the two obscurations, the obscurations of omniscience to the afflictions, which is the hearers even get rid of that. Those and the obscurations to omniscience. So the extra level of obscuration that the Buddha has to get rid of in order to for omniscience to dawn, in order for the full power of her mind to be revealed. You know, you have to get rid of the obstructions to omniscience. Those are false appearances. So the Buddha's mind isn't obstructed. Just because there's a wall between you and the street wouldn't stop the Buddha seeing the street as clearly as he sees the door. Mind is completely unobstructed throughout all samsara nirvana. So that's so it's not just the emptiness of his mind, it's the emptiness of a mind which is purified of the two obscurations. So that emptiness is a kind of a unique emptiness for a Buddha. But I think, yeah, in the autonomy school they say that the mere absence of the defilements, yeah, the mere absence of the obscurations, they don't necessarily call that an emptiness. That's just the sheer absence of the afflictions in that mind, and then the emptiness of that mind. So both of those are just a permanent phenomena. The true cessation of all your afflictions and your obscurations that you've been working to get rid of. For all those years and kind of lives of coursing as a bodhisattva, and then the natural emptiness of that mind anyway. So those are the two purities, or the two freedoms that the nature body has. So it's just that permanent feature, that neither form nor consciousness feature of the Buddha. final nature, you see? The final nature, when nature is the ultimate nature of the Buddha. So that's probably enough of that. So then we come to 3b, which is Dharmakaya, yeah? Or, well, we say the wisdom truth body, yeah? Yeshichoku. So here, when you say wisdom truth body, Jane, you see you're talking about the actual, now we're talking about the consciousness element of a Buddha. But if you just say Dharmakaya, then that can be maybe understood a little bit differently sometimes. You would think of Dharmakaya as what? As the emptiness. Yeah, that wouldn't primarily be the way I'd immediately think of if somebody said Dharmakaya. You see, when you have a Buddha, you can divide how many bodies? You can divide it into two, you can divide it into three, you can divide it into four, and maybe more than that, right? So in the commentaries of Haribhadra and people on the perfection, on the ornament of clear realization, they're concentrating on four in the eighth chapter. In the fourth chapter, only three were mentioned. You know, you can condense the four into three. But you can also condense the three into two. So you can start off, you know, the simplest level, you can talk about two Buddha bodies. So maybe we should do that just to get this idea of Dharmakaya a bit more clear. So obviously Buddha, you know, single entity, you know, you're seeing him as one. But then to get a clearer picture of what a Buddha is, you start doing the divisions. So then the simpler division is into two. So then you would say there's the Dharmakaya, the truth body, and that's for yourself, right? And then there's the form body, and that's the Rupakaya, for others. Okay, so if you're doing a simpler division into two, make a note of those two. Or, you know, you'll come across them anyway when you get around to studying this more. Truth body, In Sanskrit, Dharmakaya, form body, in Sanskrit, Rupakaya, Chirku Sukku in Tibetan. So that's, you know, just simpler division. Dharmakaya, Rupakaya, truth body, form body. And then the Tibetans add on a little bit, you see. They say, truth body for the self, form body for others. Truth body for yourself, form body for others. So you're saying to yourself, may I become enlightened for the sake of all sentient beings? So when you do become enlightened, you know, if it was just you, what you've got is this Dharmakaya, which is, you know, you're the exalted wisdom knower, but still you've got the emptiness of that mind, you know, so that's the Dharmakaya to me. It's mainly the all-knowing wisdom, the omniscient mind. And then, of course, the emptiness of it is when you separate that out, it becomes the nature body. But that's the Dharmakaya. And that's what you achieve. When if you achieve your highest evolution, this mind we've got now, eventually, you know, when it's purified of all its hindrances, is, you know, then you've got the mind of a Buddha, haven't you? So that's you on the Buddha ground. But you don't stop there because your main work is then to be a benefit to others. So then you want the form body, which is the form body for others, you see. Truth body for yourself, form body for others. So then you are not going to stop there because if you just have that wisdom body, you know, then you are okay, you are enlightened. But how are you communicating with people or other creatures, wherever they are? So then you remain your Dharmakaya, your exalted wisdom consciousness remains in meditative equipoise. And without shifting from meditative equipoise, you are appearing in whatever guise is suitable for the trainees. So that's the form body. So the form body divides into this enjoyment body and emanation body. Two types of form body, two main types. See what I mean? So if you're talking about two, you're talking about dharmakaya, rupakaya, truth body, form body. But you can see how those are then divided. So the dharmakaya, they like to divide that up then into the actual wisdom, which is the functioning thing. This is the consciousness. So that's here we've got, that's called the wisdom truth body on our paper. That's the how it appears in the ornament, according to the commentaries of Haribhadra and his lineage. And then the other division of the dharmakaya in this way of looking at it is the nature body. So that's the emptiness of that mind, and that mind's freedom from all obscurations, freedom from the adventitious defilements, freedom from, you know, being inherently existent, natural purity. So you can see how the dharmakaya divides into those two. One of is consciousness, the other one is this permanent phenomena, this permanent nature of the dharmakaya. And then the other one, the form body, divides into two. You divide into the enjoyment body and the emanation body. Well, I think some gods can be high bodhisattvas, yeah. High bodhisattvas can take birth in the god realms, so they could be perhaps in the retinue of that enjoyment body. Probably if you get to be a god, you'll be too blissed out, but some of them can keep their concentration. So there's different kinds of gods, yeah. You know, so... Yes, in general, that's a criticism of the God world, but some bodhisattvas can take birth there and not lose it, you know, because they're bodhisattvas. They're able to continue their bodhisattva progress and teach people in the God realms. But there are certain births, they say, the way you can't teach. No bodhisattvas get born in the formless realm, because the formless realm gods, they are... That's a solitary experience. There isn't any communication. They don't have any form body. They don't communicate. They just are in meditative equipoise on something like endless space or endless consciousness. So those people and gods of the formless realm, their experience is so, you know, isolated, so just tranquil that they don't even communicate with anybody else. So bodhisattvas don't get born there because there's nobody to teach. Nobody can listen to them there. Well, Buddha became, our Buddha, he became a bodhisattva in the home realms, didn't he? That's where he first generated bodhicitta. But then immediately he was reborn out of hell. But certainly bodhisattvas pray to be born in hell, don't they? In order to be of use. But what use there can be, I don't know, if there are some beings whose karma isn't so heavy that they can help them. You know, most beings in hell, the karma must be so heavy that nobody can help them. I don't know. Yeah, anyway, so that's a bit of a sort of a hierarchy. Where do these four, you know, you fold them back into the what's being divided... These are the divisions. What is being divided? So you can reduce them into three, into two, into one. But here we've got four. Yes. Yes. So I don't think I wrote the Sanskrit names down, but you'll find them in the handbook. Yeah, so I'm just coming to those in a minute. So we'll get return back to those questions. Yeah. So now we're on the wisdom truth body. which is 3b on my handout. And that's application of the equality of existence of peace gets you to this wisdom truth body. So that's the knower of all aspects, the exalted knower of all aspects. That's the omniscient consciousness, the omniscient wisdom. It's sort of mental consciousness. It's not the sense consciousnesses of a Buddha. So Buddha does have different sense consciousnesses. They're also omniscient, but the wisdom truth body is the mental consciousness, the yogi dharya perceiver. That's the actual one which has, you know, done all the work in order to get enlightened. The sense consciousnesses are still there. You know, when Buddha is walking on this earth, he has sense consciousnesses. He has a tongue consciousness, a nose consciousness, an eye consciousness. Those are also all omniscient, but they're sense consciousnesses. They aren't this wisdom truth body. Okay, so the wisdom whose perception is consummate relative to the mode and diversity. So that's a very kind of, you know, Hopkins way of saying something, I think. But it just means he sees the mode. It means the mode of being. That means the way things are. So that means the ultimate truth. He sees the profound ultimate truth of all phenomena. So mode is like the mode of being, yeah? The way of being is the way things are, ultimate truth. And he also sees equally clearly with direct perception. Just like you're seeing an olive in the palm of your hand, you see the diversity, all the variety, conventional phenomena. So that's written underneath, isn't it? The mode, the ultimate mode of being a phenomena, their emptiness, their diversity, the variety of conventional truths. Thus, this is the omniscient wisdom, is equivalent to the exalted knower of all aspects. Good. So the definition is a bit sort of, you know, clumsily worded, or, you know, not clumsily, but sort of a stilted type of wording, but can't help it. That's the explanation. So I have to push on, but, we've got a bit of time this afternoon, but... maybe we should get some of this finished, really. Yeah. So the next one, then, is the enjoyment body. If you translate the Tibetan literally or the Sanskrit literally, complete enjoyment body. So we've just discussed what that means. That's the body who's very exalted in appearance, such as you find on tankers when the Buddha is sort of dressed in jewels and, you know, has an elaborate sort of hairdo and, you know, silken garments and all this. So those are kind of the enjoyment body, aren't they? Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree getting enlightened, that's an emanation body, isn't it? But the enjoyment body is a very sort of more magnificent and kind of, you know, beautifully portrayed with all the kind of, you know, decorations you can think of. But they only appear that way to the people with very bright karma, you know, with very sort of advanced levels of, you know, mental purification. So we don't have the karma to see them like that because we're so dull. And, you know, can I look at pictures of them? Unless we've got sort of training and have sort of a, you know, even though we're still human, we have sort of, you know, advanced levels of, you know, mental concentration, then maybe we can see these enjoyment bodies. Enjoyment body is like, you know, identified or, you know, ascertained by five factors. So the five factors, or they call them the five certainties, are the certainties of time, place, body, doctrine, and retinue. So these things are all definite about the enjoyment body. The time is certain. So in a complete enjoyment body lasts as long as cyclic existence is not emptied of sentient beings. But once the person has become enlightened, the enjoyment body will always be there. It will always be there teaching, it will always be there available, always there, you know, communicating. So once it's once it arises, it's there. So it doesn't pass away, it doesn't fade away, it doesn't become old, it doesn't decay. Of course, it's impermanent, it's a physical body, but it must be made of, sort of light or something. It must have been made of very superfine type of refined kind of form, not the kind of form that our bodies are made of. So, complete enjoyment body lasts as long as cyclic existence is not empty of sentient beings. Place is certain. Complete enjoyment body always stays only in the heavily adorned highest pure land. So I put the Sanskrit of that in. I didn't put the Sanskrit of the bodies in because that's in the handbook, you see. So you can look for the Sanskrit of the names of the bodies. But that's this Akanista, you might have heard of that one. This highest pure land. So that's where, that's the only place you'll find them. So they just inhabit that region, and anybody who's got the karma to see them, well, they've got the karma to go there and be there and attend. You know, the Buddha doesn't have to come around traveling on tour like, a queen or anything. Anybody who's got the karma to see them, they have the karma to go there. Body is certain. A complete enjoyment body only displays the 32 marks and 80 signs of a Buddha and does not itself display any other type of body. So the 32 marks are on the sheet of verses, the last five verses on page 4. Maybe we can just look at those in a minute. A bit of light relief. So they have, the Buddha's sort of noted, maybe you've heard of it, for having 32 marks and 80 signs. So 32 major marks and 80 sort of beautiful signs. Now the Buddha who worked the earth also has those. So it's not just having those signs doesn't mean it's an enjoyment body. The emanation body, the supreme type that comes down to earth and teaches, they also can have those marks and signs. And even the Dalai Lama is supposed to have a few, isn't he? He's supposed to have long ears and marks on his body or something. I don't know. Maybe. Maybe not. Have you got the karma to see? Some people who might just appear as a sort of, simple old man. Other people might see him in very pure form. Who knows? Anyway, the body is certain, displays 32 marks and 80 signs of a Buddha, and does not itself display any other type of body. Doctrine is certain. Complete enjoyment body only teaches great vehicle doctrine, never lesser vehicle doctrine. So that's the difference from the emanation body. The emanation body of a Buddha will teach whatever people need, even sometimes teaching non-Buddhist teachings. But the complete enjoyment body only teaches great vehicle doctrine. Retinue is certain. A complete enjoyment body is surrounded only by bodhisattva superiors, not by bodhisattva common beings, hearers or solo realizers. An enjoyment body is beautified by the 32 major marks and 80 minor signs. A supreme emanation body is also. So shall we look at the 32 marks? Wheel marks on hands and feet. So when the Buddha has a footprint, you can see a wheel mark in the footprint. You know, if you go to Bodh Gaya, you see the footprints carved in stone. There's a little wheel mark in the center of the foot. The Buddha's foot doesn't touch the ground, but still he makes an imprint that leaves this wheel mark. Thousand-spoked Dharma wheel. Tortoise feet, that means, they say that means that the foot is like the bottom shell of a tortoise, you know, the breast shell of a tortoise is very flat and smooth or something. Toes and fingers having webs between, so they have webs of light. It's not the webs of skin, but webs of light between the toes and the fingers. Light webs. That's nice, isn't it? And soft and tender are the hands and feet as well. Seven body areas prominent. So I didn't make a note of those seven. Or did I? I don't seem to have made a note of the seven body areas that are prominent. I think shoulders, you know, something like that. Maybe hands. I'm not sure. Anyway, have to research that one yourself. If you look on that Hopkins website that's mentioned, I think he gives a little bit of details at many other places. So the fingers are long, the heels broad, form tall and straight, no jutting ankles. So he hasn't got ankle bones that stick out in some sort of a pointy manner. Has anybody got jutting ankles? Show us for an example. Protruding ankles, as somebody says, but jutting is a bit shorter. Body hair grows up, so all these body hairs grow in an upward direction, that's what it means. So that's considered to be more auspicious if your body hair is growing in an upwards direction. Is yours growing up? Mine it is, if you comb it, it goes up. So I'm halfway there. Almost. Calves antelope-like, long and comely arms. The best of those whose private parts are sheathed, so that's like a horse elephant. Complexion is golden colour, skin so smooth. The body hairs curl, each curl well to the right, so they grow up and then they curl to the right. Mine are curling to the left, oh no. Out of a perm. Face graced with the urna hair. Do you know the urna hair? He has one hair in the middle of his forehead here, where the third eye is or something, according to the esoterics, your third eye. So this is where he has this urna hair, which is long hair. If you pull it, it's actually very long, but it's curled up very tightly. Yes, Buddha's got one. A lion's chest, this sort of lion's upper body, but there isn't a good word for upper body like chest or torso or something. Like a lion. And the shoulders are round and broad, the flesh between. So the flesh between the shoulders is very broad, so his shoulders are very wide or something. And pleasant taste appear as taste supreme. So like we were saying, that anything you give the Buddha to taste, it always tastes beautiful to him, tastes supreme. So if you give the Buddha old, bitter, black tea, which would taste horrible, and he tastes it as supreme, as a very beautiful taste, is Buddha having a wrong consciousness then? Actually, it tastes horrible, but him, it tastes lovely.
All these others are descriptions of body parts, and there's so many you get a function.
Well, who are we to argue? So it follows the Buddha has a wrong consciousness because it tastes horrible old, you know, stewed bitter black tea as very tasty. So that's the wrong consciousness, Stuart. Can the Buddha have a wrong consciousness? How how dreadful. So actually, everything does taste supreme. So when we have a taste of black tea tasting horrible and bitter, then we're having a wrong consciousness of it. It actually tastes really pleasant. So if it is good or bad, it has to be inherently good or bad. No. Anyway, we haven't got time. We've got to go move on. Talk about that in your discussion break. But I've got other questions to talk about, so we must move on. Form well proportioned, like a banyan tree. So that's a kind of a fig tree, isn't it? I don't know what this is called. Banyan tree. Thought I got this written down as well, but I don't know where. Oh yes, Ficus bengalensis. That's from Geoffrey Hopkins. The Ficus religiosa, that's the tree that Buddha becomes enlightened under. So that's called a people tree in India, I think. But this one is, maybe it's just a word for the fig tree. They're very beautiful big trees, like we say oak trees or something. They are these fig trees that are hugely, you know, massively kind of, you know, beautiful. Yes. If you look on the internet to find one, a picture of one, they can be really extraordinary. Like, and then when they grow, it's like the seeds are spread by birds, but they won't grow from the ground. The bird has to deposit the seed in a crack, like, you know, through, you know, doing its mess on a tree. And then that tree, the seed grows out of the tree that's already living, and then it sort of gradually grows as a parasite, but eventually it puts down its own roots, and it ends up sort of completely enveloping and strangling the host tree. And they call strangler vines, you know, in some countries like Australia where they have them. So that you can see them in India. Have you ever seen them? They're remarkable trees. Like, they gradually, over years, they will just sort of envelop the tree that they began just as a little kind of seedling growing out of, and just squash them completely and kill the tree. And sometimes they're hollow inside because the old tree has just rotted away. So you're left with this hollow trunk, you know, and all these sort of amazing kind of branches and kind of roots and so on. So they're very unusual trees, actually. Anyway, must go on. The crown protrusion. Ushnisha, that's on the top of the head. The long and handsome tongue, as sweet as Brahma's voice, and lion-like jaws. So actually, there should be a word for jaws and cheeks. You know, it's, if we say jowls, it doesn't sound very nice to say the Buddha's got lovely jowls. Yeah. If Francesca says to her husband, "What lovely jowls you've got," it wouldn't sound very good, would it? So, it's still less for a woman, but there should be a word for that, you know, cheeks, or he's got lion-like cheeks. It doesn't sound quite right, but anyway, something very majestic and kind of, you know, supreme. The teeth, pure white and even, uniform, the set of 40, all complete. Do we have 40 teeth? The usual number for a human being? I'm sure it is, but... Yes. Deep, dark blue eyes. Dark blue, dark, dark, dark blue. Eyelashes heifer-like. So very long eyelashes. These are the marks at number 32. So wonderful. Okay, so we'll stop there. We're in the middle of doing the bodies, but I want to go on to the discussion question for after lunch. So you need your handwritten paper now. Has everybody got one? So this is the debates on karma. Remember on that verse we've just done about the first of these Pure Land trainings, equality of existence and peace. So it says, and the phenomena are dreamlike, so there's no fixating on existence, peace. To there's no karma, and such like debates, the answers are as is explained. So you get the answers also in the sutra, but they're troubling questions. So once the Madhyamakas, the middle way, start saying all things are like dreams, then that's where the lower schools start to have their doubts, yeah? That's where they start to think of these middle ways as, you know, being a bit too airy-fairy, verging on nihilism. We can't have that, can we? That's throwing out the baby with the bathwater. It's all right to say some things are selfless and empty, but if you say everything is just dreamlike and like a mirage, then you're throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Have you ever done that? That would be a childhood trauma, wouldn't it? Well, that's the accusation. These are debates against the perfection of wisdom by the people who feel that it's going too far, you see. So first of all, the verse 60, as Gareth Sparham, you know, explains it, he translates it and then puts in the words, Tsongkhapa puts in the words to fill out the meaning. You know, it's a word commentary. So, because bodhisattvas realize that the dharmas of samsara and nirvana are like dreams, have no truth to them, they do not construct a difference between them, i.e. between an existence to be rejected and a peace to be embraced. They're all the same in being lacking inherent existence. So, you know, discriminate them as like, you know, fair and foul or something, you know, what's going on? And the hearers are saying, you know, the lower schools are saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, you can't just do that. If everything's like a dream, are you devaluing everything? You know, putting on everything on the level of just being, you know, just inconsequential. It doesn't matter if you kill somebody in a dream, that's not killing, right, is it? So are you saying killing in a waking life is just the same as killing in a dream? So then you are, you know, you're sabotaging the rule of karma. And if you're sabotaging the law of karma, then how can you claim you're a Buddhist? You're just a nihilist. Yeah, so this is the realist objection in the form of a consequence. Yeah. So during the waking state, the 10 unwholesome actions such as killing do not exist, just as they do not exist in a dream state, because all dharmas are essenceless, like dreams. So they're accusing the Madhyamakas, the middle wayers, of destroying karma. Fair argument, right? So how would you answer that? You're a middle wayer, you know. We study the consequence of this view. We go to Jamyang Center, London, you know, follows the Dalai Lama. We're middle wayers, you know. But how can you posit karma if you say all the things are just like dreams? You kill someone in a dream. You wouldn't lose your vow, would you? If you were a monk and you just dreamt you killed somebody, you wouldn't lose your vow of killing. A vow of not killing, you know, a vow of promising not to kill. So then, you know, if waking life is just like dreams, then if I kill somebody in waking life, then I wouldn't be breaking my vow. Because it's just like dreams, according to you Madhyamakas. But how can you commit negativity in a dream? It's just a dream, right? So if you dream you're stealing a gold ring, do you steal a gold ring? Don't quibble. Look, if you steal a gold ring in a dream, is it breaking the your lay vow against stealing? You accept? Yeah? So if you win $1 million in a lottery, then you win $1 million. It follows if you win $1 million in a dream, in your dream, if you win $1 million in a lottery, it follows you do win $1 million, because if you steal a gold ring in a dream, you steal a gold ring.
No.
So if you steal a gold ring in your dream, it doesn't follow that you break your vow of stealing. Yeah, okay. You wish to steal the gold ring in a dream. You go ahead to steal the gold ring in a dream. You actually steal the gold ring in a dream. And afterwards you feel, oh, wow, now that gold ring is mine. So the four factors are all complete. So if you steal a gold ring in your dream, you lose your lay vow against stealing. Yes. Well, that's not how they're looking at it here. They're saying, you know, that's the absurd consequence, yeah? Yeah, we're saying that the realist is saying, look, just if you do the act of killing in the waking state, it follows you do not perform, you know, the negative action of killing, because it's just like a dream, yeah? So they're saying, they're putting it the other way around. So a monk, if he dreamt he killed somebody, then he'd have to lose, he'd have to give his vows back. You know, he wanted to do it, he did it, he shot his, you know, he got out the gun, he shot the person, and afterwards he said, yeah, I've done it. Pardon? Yeah, then he wakes up. Yeah, but has he broken his vow of killing? He's rejoiced even when he's awake. Okay, he says, yeah, I really want to kill that guy. Has he broken his vow of killing? No. You have to debate against Alistair now. So this is the realists are really charging the Madhyamakas with nihilism. You're saying if you take your middle way view and say that's what the Buddha taught, then you know you can no longer present the doctrine of karma. So if you can't have the doctrine of karma, everything collapses. Yeah, it doesn't matter whether you do a good deed or a bad deed. It's just all the same. There's no morality anymore. You know, there's no Four Noble Truths. There's no cause of suffering, and there's no sort of path out of suffering. So it's a kind of very heavy charge. So, you know, listen to what this gentleman says here. He says, yeah, the Madhyamakas say that everything that exists originates in dependence upon causes and conditions, so all things are empty, i.e. devoid of intrinsic nature. Yeah, but if you say that, then he says this also entails that ultimately nothing whatever originates. Yeah. Okay. Ultimately, nothing originates. That's what they're saying. Everything exists in dependence upon cause and conditions. So nothing originates ultimately. Everything everything in the, originates in dependence on causes and conditions. So therefore, all things are empty. All things have no intrinsic nature. So then, ultimately, nothing whatever originates. So then, if nothing whatever originates, you can't say that things originate in relations of dependent origination, mutual interdependence. I like it. It makes sense to me. The Madhyamikas are nihilists. The charge of nihilism is not without some plausibility. This is exactly what follows from the claim that all things are empty in the Madhyamika sense, lacking intrinsic nature. See, the Abhidharmas, like we said in our meditation, you know, the Abhidharmas, the lower schools, the Vibhasikas, Satrantikas. So what they're saying is, you know, like Vaspandu says, if you can't split it apart and can't analyze it any further, then it really exists, right? So this is what Vasubandhu, when he's talking about the Satrantic view, means when he makes the criteria of dharmahood, you know, what it is to be a phenomena, is that which continues to exist after separation and analysis. Yeah, so all the things that are made out of parts, you can say they are conceptually constructed, and they are, you know, a certain amount of that is just, you know, it's just your mental involvement that generates the idea of self, you know. But the bits that you're made of, you know, all the things that are made of parts and the aggregates and the self that's imputed on the aggregates, they're all sort of conceptual, you know, efforts by the mind. But the ultimate building blocks out of which they're all conceptually constructed, they've got to exist. How do we know to impute Susan here on this set of five aggregates? Because there's something, you know, there's something there those are Susan's aggregates. There's Susan's DNA is there or something, you know. Susan's characteristics are contained within those aggregates, so it's correct to impute Susan there. But here on this sort of like doggy aggregates, you know, furry with this sort of, you know, four legs instead of two arms and two legs, there we don't impute Susan because there's nothing in the, you know, in there that is kind of has any Susan nature. They've got doggy nature, so we don't impute Susan there. So there's got to be something like the ultimate building blocks have got to stay in place in order for the imputation to be correct. So that's the Satrantic view, you see. Yes, we understand the imputation, we understand selflessness, we understand imputing the self in dependence upon the aggregate. But then if there aren't any ultimate building blocks to discriminate this specific imputation from that basis of imputation, then whenever you impute Susan, she would have to be there. So even that dog would have to be Susan. So we want some ultimate building blocks that have a nature that's entirely their own. They bear the nature independently of other things. So how can you have any stable basis for any, you know, your imputations unless there is something, you know, intrinsically there from the building block side? Otherwise, it's all like dreams, you know. I dreamed I killed somebody, and then that would be like that to be the karma of killing. Or else, in waking state, I killed somebody. It doesn't matter. It's only like a dream, you know. It's only like, you know, I'm just imputed killing onto something, which is only a mental effort. But actually, no killing took place because ultimately there is no killing. So that's the Abhidharma view. So they, and then the Chittamatrians come along and say, oh yeah, there's no reality in the building blocks that are outside because you just deconstruct those building blocks and there isn't anything there. You just go on having more and more parts. So everything's got parts. So everything's just conceptual fiction on that side. But you have to say everything is like determined to be what it is by the mind that's producing those appearances. So the mind has some sort of ultimate reality. The mind has some sort of, becomes the bedrock on which you can found your, you know, that's a valid cognizer. This is actually blue, and this is not blue. Because the consciousness which is producing the appearance has a sort of intrinsic nature of being, you know, a consciousness that is kind of, you know, ultimately established. So So there's a way that the Chittamatrayas have of coming back to, oh, it's all based on the mind, and okay, even if there's no external reality, they're still blue, they're still red. Those appearances are valid to be called blue and red, because the mind that's producing them is kind of, you know, has a sort of a ultimate reality. But the middle way has come along, oh, nothing has any ultimate reality at all, you know. Nothing has any intrinsic kind of nature of its own that sort of self-validating. So then we're all completely in a soup of anything goes then, isn't it, you know? What's morality then? Oh, it's just what people say it is, you know? So the majority wins then. So how's that? How can you have that being correct morality? Just when everybody, the majority of people say that's what's good or that's what's bad. That's what you're left with. It's just like, you know, crowdfunding, isn't it? The majority of people don't say you have to keep your vows, do they? That's a very minority thing. You should have a vow against killing and then keep it. The majority don't say that. So that's you know, you lose out. That wouldn't be morality anymore because that's not a majority view. So that's the discussion question. And there's a counter objection by the middle ways. We haven't had time to talk about that, so that's maybe you should just... obviously, you can look at it and think about it, but it's not, the middle ways aren't answering the realist objection. They're not saying, you're wrong, this is how to understand the middle way view. You know, you've made a mistake there. They're not saying that. In this objection that I've written down, the middle ways are criticizing the realist view and say, look, you realists, you think you've got it all sorted out, and we're the nihilists, but you, in your realist position, you also... You know, it's you who can't present the vow of, you know, the unwholesome action of killing properly. Yeah? For instance, you know, you say everything that happens to you is because of karma. Right? So if somebody comes along and kills you, it's your karma that you get killed. So that's why you die. Yeah? So there's a, where does it come in that somebody's committed a negative action? You died because of your own karma. Not that person had to kill you. You died. You know, it's your karma to be there and to die at that point. Yeah. So why has that person got to be blamed for, at all? You know. So it's you. It's you really. You've got. You know. You can't present karma properly. You know. So we've got a counter objection to your objection. We're not answering your objection except by giving an objection to your view of karma. And Gaddis Barham, in his translation, he calls it boomeranging. Your unwelcome consequence boomerangs on you. Because, you know, we can give just exactly the same type of consequence which, you know, objects to your view of karma as being kind of, you know, up the creek. So Gareth Sparham calls that boomeranging. I can't imagine Tom Carper writing that. Because it's a translation of Tom Carper. Your unwelcome consequence has the unfortunate effect of boomeranging. I mean, how's Tom Carper ever going to have heard of a boomerang? Did they have them in Tibet, ancient Tibet, boomerangs? Have to go to Australia, mate, if you want a boomerang. So that's your discussion. You have to answer that question. The Madhyamaka says, oh, phenomena are just like dreams. You know, we're great yogis. But then what happens to karma? Finished. Is the offering prayer there? Om Ahum, Om Ahum, Om Ahum. To the precious Buddha, peerless guide, to the precious Dharma, peerless refuge, to the precious Sangha, peerless liberators, we offer to the three jewels of refuge. This food with 100 flavors, attractive and well prepared, is offered to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas with devotion. May all beings enjoy the wealth of the food of concentration. Seeing this food as medicine, we eat it without attachment or hatred, not out of avarice, pride, or a wish for an enviable body, only to sustain the body.